pack your knives and stay. Yes, stay. It is the Return of the Judges Table podcast here at Reality TV Wrap Ups. Hello, everyone. I am Antonio Mazzaro. We're back this week to talk about Top Chef Season 14, Episode 13, Trial by Fire. And I'm joined today by two of my favorite hot peppers. Maybe not, you know, that at all. But it's Mike Bloom. Mike, how are you?
I feel as gutted as a fish stuck on a grill, but otherwise, I'm managing.
I should have tested you out first. Josh Wiggler, you're back. How are you?
I'm back, and I know you're disappointed. I know you thought that I was cheese, and it just turns out that I'm Josh Wiggler instead.
Yeah, that's why I just lumped it into hot peppers, because really, I don't know the ingredients in either of you, so I'm just going to assume that that's what we're dealing with here. And I'm wearing my latex gloves, so we're ready to jump here. Kurt Clark is not here this week. Mike, you have an update from Kurt. Where is Kurt right now?
All right, I'm reading this verbatim from the one and only Kurt Clark. He tells us to just say I'm not around because I was meat slapped by John Tesar, and I will give a brief report during our finale coverage.
Oh my God.
And take in, putting out of it back context, into context.
That sounds terrible. Yeah. Oh,
let's
bad.
Place that firmly back into context, like a tamal stuffed inside a fish at this point. So as if you recall from last week's podcast, Kurt was going to Dallas for work the next week, and he actually dined at Knife from John Tesar. If you follow him on social media at all, you will see he had what looked like a pretty damn good meal and a great time talking with John. I'm sure we could not do the conversation or the meal justice ourselves. So we're going to have Kurt on next week, obviously, for the finale, and he can give us the full details. But for now, he is profoundly meat-slapped.
I'm excited because I've got questions for Kurt Clark. I'm looking at one of these pictures on Instagram from Kurt's trip to Knife Dallas, and there's a bacon flight with sriracha pork belly that looks really interesting, but it also looks like it's spelling something out, and I've been trying to crack the code. It's another Tatagio, I think we're trying to deal with here. There's like a K in the bacon. I want to figure out what the message is.
I want to figure out what is going on in general, because I received a series of text messages from Kurt that night, which were short and odd. Just like they were just like half thoughts. Like,
he's communicating in Tatagio. That's what's happening.
He just would text like "I just" with like three dots, and that was the text message. He was rendered speechless by whatever happened at Knife Dallas. So yeah. I guess shout out to whatever happened at Knife Dallas. We'll hear more from Kurt when he returns. It sounded like an incredible experience he had there. So. I'm not sure. He'll come up for air at some point, and he'll be back for the finale. But yeah, as everyone said, follow Kurt on social media. You'll find him at Kurt Clark on Twitter and probably find links to the rest of what he's got there. And you can maybe get into the whole story and get in the back and forth with him. But he is not here to talk about this week's episode, guys. And probably it's for the best, because I think he might be crying. I don't know. There are a lot of sad faces in the audience after this week. It's a really great final four, honestly. And going down into the final three now, we've talked about it throughout. We're going to be killing our darlings, like people that we really would love to see win the season are going week to week, and we still have people left that everyone is thrilled with. But I think that the general consensus was this was a real heartbreaker.
Yeah, I think that you even get that, you know, in the final scene of the episode, you know, when Padma is delivering the news and Tom is giving his Tom Colicchio spiel that can often be like, you know, very toothsome, that can really be like a dressing down. And this was really a lifting up of like, look where we are. We're in this cave. We get to do what we love to do every day. How lucky are we? Like the tears in Padma's eyes as she delivers the news. No one was happy about this. Audience member, chef, judges alike. No one was thrilled about how this went down, and no matter how it broke, it was going to be heartbreaking.
That being said, not Sheldon's finest hour. I love Sheldon to death. I will, you know, give him praise to the moon and back and then some. But I think even Sheldon would admit that, you know, this hour is going to contain him misunderstanding Spanish that allows him to get a tamale instead of cheese, which screws up the quick fire. And in the elimination challenge, he's done in by leaving some fish stuck on the grill. And as a result, it comes out, you know, as Tom tries to positively paint as lump crab meat. I think even Sheldon would admit that this was not a great episode for him. I guess I'll sort of mirror what I said a couple of episodes ago when Brooke ended up going the first time out, where at least from a personal standpoint, I saw Sheldon going probably at about like the 40-minute mark here, especially after everyone gave their comments. And really, you know, Brooke got some nitpicky negative commentary, but Sheldon got pretty much overwhelmingly negative commentary because of the shrimp and the overwhelming spiciness, which seems to be a theme this episode. It did not make it any easier knowing that he was going to go about 20 minutes before he did, especially when I held out hope after, you know, them sort of lavishing praise on him for at least being creative. But this was a really, really hard one to watch in particular, and especially from Sheldon's perspective, considering that this is the exact same spot he went out last
time. Brutal. Devastating.
It is. We kind of teased at this last week, but there were really not going to be many outcomes where everyone had a redemption story, in that the real outcome that would have had that is if Sheldon makes the finals, then Shirley doesn't have her "I made it to the finals" story.
Right.
And if Brooke doesn't make the finals, then she doesn't have that story. So there was really no way for everyone that was left after a certain point to get their redemption story and for it to play out that way. Somebody was going to end either where they were before or like lower than they were before. So I think that this is a very tough way for Sheldon to go out. It does seem like he would take responsibility for what happened. If the grill's not hot enough, the snapper is just going to stick to the grill. Brooke learned that because she did a test fish. Sheldon maybe felt like he didn't have time or he didn't want to do that and just went with it, and it wasn't hot enough, and there we are.
I thought that was a great question, too. It was like something that I wouldn't have even thought of, which is why I'm not a cook at their level by any stretch of the imagination. But like, did you test fish it? Like, did you put a fish on the grill just to see how that would go? That was really smart. And of course, like, that's the move in retrospect.
Yeah. And look at you, Graham Elliott, coming back after a long sabbatical and making a big impression right there, right then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing says Yucatan Peninsula like Graham Elliott, guys.
That should be on a t-shirt.
Yes, exactly.
Or Graham at least Elliott, on the side of a pair of very white glasses.
Or very, very tan glasses. Yes. It should be now.
It was nice to see him back. He did have some good comments, as you point out, Mike. I think, as I've said throughout, I feel like I liked Graham Elliott on Top Chef more than Top Chef did. But he's a busy man. He's back. No trip to the Yucatan can be turned down here. He does make the good comment. It's also classic Brooke, I think, to really be very reasoned in terms of like what she's doing. She lays it all out. She's methodical. I think Brooke has established a lot of consistency because she operates that way. She plans everything out. And I think a lot of the times when she struggled on this season, it's been one of those challenges where they say they're forcing you to be creative and forcing something that she normally would lay out in a step-by-step process. And I think cooking the test fish really did help her out here. And it did seem to be the difference between her making the finals and not making the finals. So preparation is everything, and proactive work like that really seemed to seal the deal here. So it is a shame that it came down to something like that instead of two of their best dishes going head to head, and them really just kind of looking at, this was a better conceived dish, or this was more surprising, or whatever. There just seemed to be an error in delivery here, and that error was too much to overcome. Even though it did come off, the snapper came off like lump crab meat, and that fit into the crab flavors and everything that was going on with the dish. It was clearly an error. We could see the fish still on the grill. That was really ultimately the reason. And it's a sad way to go, I think, for a chef who, sans that error, has presented really incredible food all season long. And clearly, in Tom's mind, as Tom has repeatedly said now, is going to take his place as one of the greatest chefs in the country. So incredible feedback to receive when you're the third place finisher on a Top Chef season. And not only to receive it once, but to receive it twice. I think it's crystal clear, even though we've not had the food as the audience, that Chef Wonder, that Sheldon, is just an incredible chef. And it's a real shame to see him go home here.
There's a great article in Vulture. I don't know if you guys saw this in New York Magazine's Vulture blog, which covers TV and pop culture and stuff like that. And it's by E. Alex Jung, or Jung, I'm not sure how that's pronounced, that is a first-person account of going to eat some of Sheldon's food at the remember, Sheldon won he won a challenge earlier in the season that allowed him to cook at the James Beard House. Is that
yes.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yes.
I think he cooked like a few days ago this week. So
yeah,
he had a pretty balanced out week. He got eliminated from Top Chef, but at least yeah. he got to cook in one of the most prestigious places in the world.
Yeah, it's good timing, but it sounds incredible. It sounds like a great meal. So you watch the way that he cooks, obviously on the show, but if you read about how he's cooking too, really makes you hungry. So it's clear that this guy knows what he's doing. His warmth and his personality shine all over everything he does on the show, and you can imagine that extends to his food, and you just want to eat that stuff. So it would be great. It would be great to get some. To get some more Sheldon in our lives. I hope that this is not the end of Sheldon in pop culture, in all of that. But it's really rough for him to go out this way.
Well, not to mention, this might be a bold prediction on my part, but I'm pretty sure he has a good 10K wrapped up pretty much in his bank account, considering his edit this week and us going into him versus Shirley in terms of the fan favorite vote next week.
You think Sheldon's got that on lock?
I think so, completely. Not to compare this too much to Survivor, but I know that, you know, Rob Cesternino says with Survivor, when they used to do the fan favorite vote, that, you know, the last episode before the voting can be very indicative. That's why Brenda Lowe, for example, won the fan favorite during Survivor Karamoan, which, you know, is pretty ridiculous considering how the rest of the season played out. I think Sheldon being so visible, especially
during
this latter half of the season.
Am I making that up?
Oh, maybe Malcolm did win. Maybe Brenda was in second. Yeah. But he got beat by Alyssa Walsh. That's why I was conflating two different instances. But I do think that Sheldon's really positive energy, as you just mentioned, Josh, and really fun edit. Even in this episode, he gets in a nice, you know, Jay-Z music video reference when they go to the resort at the very beginning, combined with, I mean, as you said, Antonio, that last scene is just brutal and heart-wrenching and so freaking emotional that, I mean, I know I was definitely tearing up, and not from chopping habaneros, just from the pure emotional aspects of it. I feel like that combination has to give Sheldon the fan favorite award at this point.
I was surprised, and this is not a knock on anybody, but I was surprised that when I saw that it was reduced to the final two and we were dealing with Sheldon and Shirley, with the way that the show's been presented, as you guys are talking about, I'm not surprised that we have those two in the final two. I was just a little surprised that we cut it and that Brooke wasn't one of the two, because Brooke has also had just a great story on this season. But I agree that it just seems like Sheldon, the story is so good and the edit is so good, and I think the darkest moment Sheldon had on this season was when everyone around him were being assholes. And Sheldon was just like, I don't like this in the world. I don't want this in my world. I don't want this. It was like a foul smell in the kitchen, like spoiled his food. And that was like the worst moment for Sheldon on this season, when other people were being negative. So I just think that he's such a positive
force.
Great
guy. Great guy. Yeah. Fantastic human being, he seems like.
Yeah, he really, really does. And it's a shame on some level that his Top Chef story it does not have a different chapter than his last. But I mean, when you're on this season with all these talented people, it feels like a different chapter, even though your place is the same. It just feels like, yeah, you made it here with a lot of really incredible people. You did great work on this season. I don't think there's any shame in going out when you go out, even though it's on a mistake. And I think that the fan favorite voting is going to reflect a lot of that. And he just had great moments. We saw like the montage of a lot of his dad jokes and the funny things he said on the season. We saw him throwing food back and forth with his lovely wife Janice. Like, there's just so much.
Yeah, that like montage of like closing out his time on the season, like, when he's like, "You got Tom to eat okra? I got you, Tom." Like, it was so great. It was a really great piece of editing.
And then pair that with, you know, Sheldon. I don't know when they recorded his confessional, but I mean, he just seems so emotionally drained, yet so emotionally peaked at the same time. I don't know if that disparity makes sense when he was talking at the camera during his talking head. You know, I think it's just very clear to him how much it definitely hurt him to be able to make it this far once again, in spite of, I mean, I had almost forgotten about the back injury. You know, when they do this whole thing of like, hey, we all had our trials and tribulations. Right. Remember when I had a back injury? I had almost completely forgotten about that, because that was like 10 weeks ago at this point. But to have him overcome that, make it so far, only to lose out again, and as much as Tom talked you up, it's got a sting, and you could feel that sting in Sheldon's eyes. Someone who I have a feeling would never get angry at any point in his lifetime. To see him instead channel that into just despair and sadness was a little tough to watch.
Yeah, I have a feeling Sheldon gets angry. We're all human beings.
Oh, yeah,
but,
sure.
But I would love
to see angry Sheldon.
I'm not sure I would.
You don't want to see me when I'm angry.
You don't like me when I'm angry. Yeah, that'd be great.
He'd be a great
Hulk.
He would be a great Hulk, right?
The
Shulk. The secret is he's always angry, guys. The Shulk.
I think that's the Hulk's cousin, I believe. Sorry, that's a Marvel
joke. He lives
joke.
In Hawaii. It's the Hulk, the Hulk's Hawaiian cousin. Sorry. Yeah. He just seems to handle a lot of situations differently than even chefs that we see on this season who do really well in high stress and high pressure situations. He's really shined. We saw that in his first season in the restaurant wars and the things that he was able to overcome where other chefs really did struggle. He just has always done really kind of in the moment, just really great, like level-headed work on the show, which is a show that really knocks people for a loop who even handle this sort of stress on a regular basis. So he really does present incredibly well as a human being and as a person and as a chef on Top Chef, which is no small feat. I bring up season 10. I think it's interesting that we had Kristen, Brooke, and Sheldon all on season 10, all looking like they could easily be Top Chef winners. That was a season where we also had three returning chefs, two of whom are Stefan and CJ, the other one I won't mention. But I do think it,
Thank
I mean,
you.
Is this a...
It's too early very, to puke, Antonia.
Oh, yeah, Blair. We're going to reset that one. But, yeah I just want to know, like, does season 10 look even better? Is there a way to make season 10 look worse? Like, where does season 10 improve or not improve based on the performance of Sheldon and Brooke on this season? Are we looking back at season 10 like, wow, I mean, maybe that was... A top-heavy cast, but it was a loaded top-heavy cast.
I feel like, I mean, I still look back on that season and think that that was a really fun season. I loved that cast. I mean, certainly at least one person who is a little bit Voldemort-esque, but I feel like for the most part it was really good. But I think that this probably does heighten it a little bit to see Sheldon and Brooke make such deep runs again, and John's redemption too.
Right.
I think it's really gonna enhance the rewatch factor on a season like that for sure.
Yeah, I think there might be some people out there who honestly remember Top Chef Seattle as, oh, that's the one where Kristen controversially got eliminated during Restaurant Wars and then won her way back in LCK. There might be some people who don't really think about Sheldon or think about Brooke. And so maybe it's an opportunity for those people to sort of think more fondly about season 10, to sort of look past the possible controversies that may have happened and say, oh, yeah, this is a really great season that had a really, really qualified group of chefs, so much so that our fourth place finisher in this season finished what? Like 10th in that season, which I think just shows the crazy amount of quality, with the exception of maybe one or two people that must not be named across those chefs.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't mean to leave Chef John out. Like, his story is a huge part of that. And then you look at season 10, I mean, it's not only that Brooke and Sheldon could have won. I mean, John sitting at the final four, I think everybody, there were a lot of people. I know we got a feedback from a lot of people that were listening to the podcast. People would have thought that John was a good winner of this season. And I feel the same way. So I just think it's interesting because if you look at some of the names that are involved in season 10, and I won't single any of them out, but they don't really stand out as chefs on Top Chef or within Top Chef history. There's a lot of kind of replacement level chefs, it seems like, as chef testants. But it's really incredible to see the amount of talent that's really there at the top of this heap. And it makes you wonder, like, if someone like John goes out ninth on season 10, are there other people that finished in the middle of the pack in other Top Chef seasons who we really didn't get to see their best on the show and would dominate on a second appearance? So it's just very impressive, I think, to look back at season 10 and see where everyone goes. And I don't think there's any shame in Sheldon finishing in the same spot, considering the level of talent we saw on this season. It's just, it was a little difficult to watch. And I want to kind of talk about the challenge design, because it did kind of doom Sheldon to be cooking over this open flame. Certainly his choice to not do a tester was part of that. But I'm wondering, Mike, was this too late in the season to have kind of such a wonky challenge?
Well, you probably know my thoughts after listening to the diatribe that I went on last week. And now that Kurt's not on, we can fully disparage it. No, I actually, looking back on this challenge, I actually like the idea of it. It didn't seem too gimmicky to me at the onset. I actually really like these cultural connections, these historical connections. You know, it might be comparable to like in Boston when they had to do the first Thanksgiving and only use, you know, tools and cooking methods that they would do back in colonial Boston, for instance. But I like the connection here. I mean, where they were cooking, I forget how to pronounce the name of that national park, but I mean, right out of Temple of Doom, it looked awesome. And to be able to really connect with that cultural history of the region, which, you know, people might not necessarily know about, is great as well. And I like the idea of you can use ingredients and cooking methods, you know, only used by the Maya. That's not too out there for me. I think if I'm nitpicking, I don't know if I necessarily liked them not knowing what was in the pantry and what they were cooking with until they got there. I would have much rather have liked them to at least have the day to plan out what they're doing. I mean, let's remember last season's history challenge where the East has to go to the library and do research and come up with, you know, a specific historical period and how they cooked a dish back then. That allowed them to really take the time to plan things out. And as a result, there was really a bounty of fantastic dishes. Here, I mean, you talked before about how Shirley's going to run away with this challenge, and Brooke and Sheldon are going to have much more problems because I feel like they're going to walk in there and say, oh, well, there goes my planning out the window. We don't have any garlic, no onions. Okay, I guess I'm going to have to plan something. I kind of wish they had the opportunities to look at what was going to happen in there and say, now that I have these ingredients, let me figure out a dish for me to cook tomorrow.
Yeah, I think that's 100% the biggest critique. I couldn't say it any better than that, Mike. I 100% endorse that. What I will say is, in defense of the idea of the competition, of having something that's really, really out there and really, really kind of hard to do this late into the competition, I think it's an equalizer to some degree, right? Because you've got three really, really great chefs here in the top three. You would really be happy, or at least I would be very happy to see any one of these three win at this point. Mm-hmm. It's a really difficult decision to make. When we get to this stage of the competition and the degree of skill is so high and the degree of difficulty is so high that it really sometimes does come down to like a pinch of salt to make a decision, why not throw something at them that all of them should probably be a little thrown by and see who rises, see who falls, and let the chips fall where they may from that. I think it's actually something of an equalizer in having something this far out there this late in the competition.
Shirley does make that comment, right? She says, like, we're all going to use the same ingredients. It's just a matter of who can unlock it or who can kind of solve this. And her mindset when the aromatics and certain other ingredients were missing was just like, well, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to take this on, and I'm going to use the ingredients I know how to use, and I'm still going to cook a good dish. I'm not going to let the fact that things are missing throw me. And you could tell Brooke's approach is much more methodical. She is more of a planner, and it did throw her, I think, for more of a loop. And as a result, the critique on her dish, and she acknowledges the problem, is that she was overwhelmed that she didn't get the ingredients that she was looking for, and that did impact her dish. So it did, I think, test the chef's ability in the moment to kind of let the water kind of fall off their back. But I don't think that necessarily tests their abilities as individual chefs. I think it certainly does kind of have an impact on what their personalities are or what their personalities can display. And I think in the moment, Shirley really rose above because she had a different viewpoint of what was going on here and just did it. So I think kudos to her really for stepping up and not letting that kind of hold her back. And it's not really a negative mark on the other chefs so much as it really is a positive mark on what Shirley was able to do in this challenge. And I think the comments that she got were in line with that, them basically saying, like, you really, there were so many ingredients out there, you could have gotten sidetracked by what to do, but part of the best part of Shirley's dish is that it was refined and that it was composed and that she did use kind of limited ingredients in a good way. So she seemed to take the negative of the challenge and really make a positive out of it. And it was a really good deal for her. Of course, the issue with Sheldon was that his fish sticks. Mike, do you like fish sticks?
Hey, I'm not Kanye West. I'm not going to answer that.
it's really unfortunate, as we talked about, that it comes down to this, but it does come down to that. I didn't really sense any other reasons that it was Sheldon's dish. I kind of, like you, Mike, felt like 40 minutes in, it seemed like Sheldon was going home. It didn't help that one of the guest judges, one of my favorite guest judges, really, I think, in Top Chef history, Ricardo Munoz Zurita, the anthropologist of Mexican cuisine, tasted Sheldon's food. He's like, it was so spicy. It really ruined it for me. It was too spicy. And that's a fire. Like, he seemed to think that there was also issues with the
you loved, you know, this man. This was your favorite guy. You were saying before the podcast that this is your favorite person that's ever been on Top Chef ever.
I loved him. He was like he should, like, in another East Coast, like, academic version of him is wearing tweeds. He's coming in like, oh, that is the very famous this, and this is, he's like educating on the ingredients, but not in like a I don't know, not in like a condescending way. He just seemed to really love what he was doing, and I thought he was really funny. He's just a nerd. He's just a Mexican food history nerd.
That's great.
It's really funny to hear that and like hear his like love for all these things. I was really all about that.
I wish that I had appreciated him more on the first watch. I will have to go back and rewatch this episode to see what you saw.
Well, when we do TOTC, that will be one that we really look out for.
Yes.
Yeah. I thought he was great. I thought the culmination of that, it was actually kind of funny, even though it was sad when he was like, it's too spicy for me. It's a fire. Like, I just thought that was it. So I really thought that it wasn't just that the fish stuck, even though that was the real big deal. There were also, I think, some issues with some of the judges, at least, and the flavor of Sheldon's dish, even though it was a bolder choice. And they said, like, he was doing more with what was going on than maybe Brooke was. Ultimately, that the fish was the clincher. We haven't talked, though, about the quick fire as much. The lack of kitchen Spanish did seem to hurt Sheldon there as well.
I'm just making the bird noises to simulate the announcement of the quick fire, like in the show.
What was going on with those birds? What were those, Mike, YouTube cans?
Yes, the YouTube cans. They're screaming for subscribes and likes.
Yeah, YouTube cans. That's different than YouTube cans. Oh yeah, so God. This is I didn't know. They said it was like built on the site of an ancient Mayan pyramid. So maybe those were like some kind of ghosts or I don't know. It was terrifying, really. Was that a hurley bird, Josh?
Well, that may have been a hurley bird, but we wouldn't be able to get that confirmed until the DVD extras.
For a second, I thought that Padma would call an audible and be like, okay, you know what your challenge is? Go kill those damn birds and cook them, okay, so they can stop bothering us.
This is the second loud bird-related incident I think we've had on this season of Top Chef. If I recall, when they went shrimping and landed on the docks, the birds were everywhere and shouting at the top of their lungs. So we've got really loud birds announcing this quickfire. We also have Padma in braids, and she's really just, I mean,
going
a walking
for that Princess Leia look, you know?
Yeah, going for that, I took a vacation at a resort in the Yucatan look and just braided her hair up.
I will say she pulls it off much more than my 11-year-old sister did when we went to the Bahamas and she got the same thing braided by some jamoke on the beach.
So
you're really mad at that guy still, right? You're really nursing a
grudge. He ripped us off! Which was my mom actually sort of ripped my sister's hair out, too, when she had to take out the braids eventually.
Oh, my God.
Tell us more, Mike. Yeah, really. This sounds like a horrifying incident from your childhood.
Oh, it was. And on top of that, we can do Mike Bloom's vacation stories at another time. But this was the same vacation where my mom broke her foot while shopping the day before we were supposed to leave. So it was, and then we flew in a blizzard. It was really just a series of unfortunate events.
Oh my God!
Did she break it off in some like bad braider's ass or what? Like, what's going on there?
She went to go kick the ass of those damn, you know, those damn shyster braiders, and she broke her foot along the way. We rode in a limo taxi and watched the VMAs on a TV in a Barbados emergency room. It was a good time had by all, and we never went on a vacation again after that.
That's the final Bloom vacation.
That was the first and only Bloom vacation. We're like, nope, this is a sign, no more.
All right, that about wraps it up for this week's Top Chef podcast. Thanks everyone for listening. Yeah, no, Mike. Yeah, we'll have to do a full Mike Bloom's vacation stories. Although it sounds like you only have kind of one, so
that's true. I think I just expanded my entire set of vacation stories.
Yeah, oh, that's the funniest thing I've heard in a while. That's so good.
It is interesting, I think, that we got the Guadalajara, Mexico experience last week, and now we have the relatable to most of the people, I think, who may be watching the show. Oh, I've been to a Secrets resort, or, oh, yeah, I've been to the Yucatan. Like, this is the resort experience, I think, is a more relatable Mexican experience, unfortunately, for the majority of us in the audience. And, I mean, maybe we haven't all cooked in a cenote and presented, like, in the sinkhole cave, like, presentation, but the resort experience, I thought that was unique. I love the market, though. I thought that market was incredible. Mike, I think our listeners were really in on that as well, right?
Yes. No no cheesiness, no queso involved there. I don't think I have it on me, but I know a lot of people were talking about just how vibrant and colorful it is. And, you know, the thing that we get from this experience that we might not get from Whole Foods, we got traces of it last week, is the ability for our chef testants to interact with the local culture. And I'd say about 66% of them interacted well with the culture in terms of it permeating into their cooking itself.
That's a very specific number, Mike. Do you have anything in mind about the 34% who didn't?
Well, I don't know if Sheldon will understand this, but I'd say that his experience was probably no bueno.
Low blow.
Josh, what happened here? It's clearly that they, Sheldon actually said to the people, tamal, and pointed at the thing. I don't think Sheldon thought tamal was cheese. He's heard of a tamale, right? Like, I think he was just rattled by the entire experience.
That seems that way. Yeah, that seems right. I mean, first off, the pressure is so high. You know, the situation that he's in right now, he's this close. He's been in the thick of the Top Chef belly for however many weeks and however many months at this point. And here he is right up against the door where he was last time. And now he's in a place that he doesn't speak the language, an overwhelming sounding competition. People make mistakes. People screw up. Sometimes you say tamale instead of queso, I guess. I guess that's how it goes.
Well, and there's a kitchen Spanish thing here. Shirley and Brooke both work in kitchens or have restaurants in California. Shirley had actually worked for Jose Andreas, so she's not only familiar with the ingredients, or not only familiar with language in the kitchen, but also really familiar with the ingredients and these kind of flavors. Sheldon cooks in Hawaii. I don't know what the kitchen situation is there, but it's probably different than the kitchen situation in California, and so he maybe doesn't have that Spanish that he's just acquired by osmosis or proximity that Brooke and Shirley seem to have. So even though they're not walking around like speaking Spanish poetry, they know enough to get the very basic things that they need for their quick fire. And I think Sheldon is rattled by the experience and doesn't ultimately grab that. I did love when he's describing his dish. He's like, it's a pan roasted, squab. Like he's talking about his dish. And then he's like, it's filled with a tamal that we got over there. He like kind of trails off. And Padma is all over that. Like, what do you mean you got it over there? Tell me more. you just feel bad for Sheldon here. Even though the market seemed amazing and there seemed to be a lot of great ingredients on display, he had a very specific thing that he needed. He was asking for queso fresco. Like, he was asking people. He knew what the words were. He knew what he was looking for. So then when he gets to this booth that has this very famous, as the nerd anthropologist chef points out, this is the legendary tamal that we do here, and they grain, you know, they all these things to process it. Sheldon, I don't know, he's been asking for queso fresco throughout. He knows the words. So he really just had to have been rattled at that point. And Brooke and Shirley were out of the market first. They're off cooking. The quick fire's time is not like a split where you have 30 minutes to shop and 30 minutes to prep. You have an hour to do both. And so I think that the fact that they were gone probably was part of that as well. He didn't want to think that they were out there cooking and he was in here running around like a chicken with his head cut off. So I think he just got rattled. I think he knew how to say, he showed that he knew how to ask for cheese. He just, at that time, stopped asking for it, and that was really rough. What about the habanero, though, guys? Are you big habanero fans?
I love habanero. Give me some of that hot sauce. Emily Fox just did a great presentation on New Orleans hot sauce, on the history of hot sauce for one of her classes at NYU, and she did very well, it seems like. No grades back yet, but she felt very confident about it. It's a shame she's not here now to give us a whole big spiel about hot sauce. Emily, take it away. Just kidding. She's not really here. But that would be great. That'd be great. You could ask her about her on Twitter. She would happily tell you everything you need to know about hot sauce.
Habaneros make a great alarm clock as well. So that's really what I primarily use it for. Horrible heartburn, though. So I guess it's a little bit of a trade-off.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't wake up with heartburn in the morning anyway, you're not living right. So
totally agreed.
Yeah, so or you're completely living incorrectly. But Shirley uses habaneros as an alarm clock. That's hilarious to me.
I don't even understand how that works.
She just keeps it in in her side drawer. When she's in the morning, she struggles to, you know, claw in the dark to find one. She takes a big bite out of one. You know, didn't Jimmy say she usually works, 10 to 12 hours a day? Assuming she's working early hours, sleeping very little, you need something to wake you up. I don't know which is unhealthier for her, habaneros or caffeine. It might be a toss-up at this point, but I guess it could function as a sort of substitute.
Well, she said the reason that she does it is that biting it gets the adrenaline going. So in that regard, you could also, as an alarm clock, just wake up with someone pounding on your door or a threat from something. she's using adrenaline to wake up, not the spiciness of the thing. So once you engage adrenaline as your wake up mechanism, I think you're on a slippery slope toward please try to mug me and I'll run away. Then I'll be really awake. So I think that that's interesting. It's funny. Shirley has a lot of these quirks that are just that make her really just so likable as a person and as a chef. And I love the talk. I mean, this is not quite like jumping off the top, the highest roof you can find when you're a kid. But this is a hilarious, like more of Shirley's extreme life where she's waking up with a habanero every morning.
I think that that's got to be the next show. That's got to be the next spinoff here is like some sort of like Jackass starring Shirley, just like extreme stunts and just inadvisable things to do, like eating a massive amounts of peppers in the middle of the night to get yourself up, throwing yourself off of the tallest building. What else would be on that show?
I want Shirley's life hacks, where it's like, yes. Hey, for that adrenaline fix in the morning, just keep a habanero pepper on the yeah. side of your bed. Just like yeah, I'm sure she has a load of them.
Shirley, you can.
Yeah, I think what else did she do? She steals fruit from her neighbors, she said. So there could be a lot of, like, there could be theft related segments. In summertime, she climbs a lot of trees. She would play with whatever that. Yeah, play with the elastic thing, you know, like a hula hoop, building fires outside her house. Yeah, we have a good idea. And unfortunately, it links right in with kind of the downside note that Shirley received from her mom after her first season, which is now that you've done so well, you can just be on TV and not cook anymore, right? Like aww. That being a reality TV star is somehow preferable to being one of the best chefs in the country to Shirley's mom. I think we really need to sit down with Shirley's family and have a long talk and say, like, your daughter is amazing. And there are people out here who watch her on TV and think, I cannot wait to eat the food that she cooks. Even though she's, you know, waking up with a habanero, like it just, she's all over it this episode and really does well. And I think it's a tough note to hear that her family still maybe doesn't approve of what she's doing, even though she clearly, in the eyes of this audience, is a beast. She's a monster. She's a fantastic chef. So hopefully her mom can listen to this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that is not necessarily new to Top Chef history. I mean, I feel like May had a very similar story last time. I mean, one of the reasons why her brother came on during that family challenge instead of her parents is that despite her very storied career so far, her parents didn't really approve of her choices. And, you know, far from it be us to, you know, insert ourselves within the Chung dynamics there, but I do hope that win or lose, that Shirley's family at least recognizes she went super far in one of the toughest, if not the toughest, cooking show that is out there. I think she has shown that she made the right choice, abandoning that mixing board once upon a time and really using her emotions and her heart to really channel that into cooking and to show how consistent she is too, and her pulling that off of a win at the very end, beating two of the biggest chefs, not only in season 10, but in Top Chef history. I mean, again, I think no matter what the outcome is next week, she should be really proud of herself, and hopefully that translates into a good outcome with her family as well.
Yeah, I hope so too. I really think that there are a lot of stories to tell in this season of Top Chef, as we've talked about. That this with when you've got eight returning players or eight returning chefs, or you've got like this group of people that all had a story on their previous season, you're going to continue to build on that. And yeah, as you point out, the family's not accepting of the profession is a story we've seen a lot. And we've seen it from all different kinds of chefs. We've seen people who are cooking to make an impression on the people that maybe have doubted them or have really risen up from a lot and really have to prove things still to people that maybe are looking at them still as a kind of a silly profession or something that's not serious. I mean, we even heard Silva on this season talking a lot about his dad, and we didn't see the note that was put on that yet. Like, we didn't really get the final button on there, and I really hope with Silva reopening his restaurant, there are the positive reviews therein send that message that, yes, I'm not what you think. Like, I'm not cooking for a specific class. Like, I am an entrepreneur, and I am an artist, and I am all these things that you should respect. And so it is a common story that we see on this show. It's just really rough to hear it like this late in the game, and from a chef who did so well on her last season. Like, I get that maybe her mom might think that you did so well on this cooking show that maybe now you can be a celebrity chef and you don't have to run a restaurant or you don't have to work your butt off. You can go and go make presentations and just be on TV and show up like Graham Elliott and, like, you know, just pop in and say a few good comments and then your job is done. But Shirley is meant to, I think, put her food on display still at this point in her career. I love with her win, she just says, I can't wait to show you. Like, she's so excited to have the opportunity to put together this full meal and really show the chefs who she is as a chef. And then in turn, I think, show anyone in the world or in her life who doubts what her skill set is or doubts the value of it, what she can do. So I think it's a really great story and button on that story from Shirley. And as you point out, Mike, and as we're talking about, not a story that we're unfamiliar with on Top Chef, but one I think we could see come to a really good conclusion, especially if Shirley were to win. Of course, we've got other stories. I mean, you talk about people coming on here to resolve issues or things happening. We see Brooke, as she's swimming and kind of snorkeling in this episode, talking about how she thinks that coming on Top Chef is a selfish act by her. And in some ways, it's very self-centered. It's like it's professional therapy. It's coming here to get re-inspired. But her story really isn't complete without this kind of win in the finals. So it is a very difficult thing where we've got two chefs with two distinct stories, both of which I think deserve a kind of a button. And I hope that both are able to get that button no matter who wins. And it'll just be interesting to see how that plays out.
Did you notice, I think I might be 13 episodes too late at this point, but I noticed in both the Quickfire and the Elimination, Brooke loves to cook with fruit, at least more so than the other chefs in the competition. I mean, you know, in the Quickfire, she officially gets crowned the Quickfire Queen because of her use in fruit in the salsas. Last week, she talked about how she was so inspired by watermelon that made her winning dish.
She's used it for better and for worse, too. I forget what it was, but wasn't there some sort of, like, lemon curd mishap several weeks ago?
Oh, yeah.
She loves fruit. Brooke loves fruit. She's a big fruit fan.
Yeah, she has done, I mean, she's done really well with pineapple. I think she won a challenge with the pineapple curd. That was the same challenge, I think, where she used her Pop Rocks. And she's just done really well throughout with food, with fruit. I think that one of the things that Brooke is known for, as we've talked about, is that she really presents great contrasts with ingredients that maybe you wouldn't necessarily expect as much. And she did that a ton when she was really streaking on season 10, when she was really winning over and over and over again. I said it in a different way, Mike, so as not to draw a remark from you, but it was too late. I know
it was too late. It's just always going to go full bloom. That was an easy one.
Yeah, it was. But she's also done. She has done. I think poorly sometimes. But yeah, the watermelon and coconut salad and the spicy watermelon she made, I think last week, right, was something that really popped. She just presents these ingredients that people don't necessarily expect to be slammed together, and she does it in such a way that is, it all elevates things. It's unique. It is, even though it's well thought out and it makes sense, it's not always something people are used to. I just think that that's a hallmark of what Brooke does as a chef. And I think it makes her food seem really exciting, and it makes what she does just seem like fantastic in terms of just the mind reels. It's not this Willy Wonka-esque molecular gastronomy like we've seen on this show. It isn't that kind of inspiration in terms of being that whimsical or that crazy or off the wall, but it is just a little bit different, and it really presents in such a special way. And I'm looking forward to seeing what she does in the finale in that regard, because we didn't even get to see her dessert that was on the finale, and we've seen her then in this season cook fantastic food in really all elements of, like, all courses. She's just done really well throughout. So it will be great to see her in her choices that she makes next week. You know, it's something she's been thinking about for a long time, how she would do a meal again. So here we are, and we're facing that off. I love that. What else from the Quickfire? Anything else jump out to you, Mike?
Let's see. I mean, Brooke decided to go for the pork loin again. She decided to dip back into that well after she was eliminated trying to sous vide that pork loin and sort of got eliminated for it. So, you know, Brooke has, looking back on this, won 75% of the challenges in Mexico. That's pretty crazy. And, you know, I think Shirley getting a win in this final elimination challenge definitely gave her a little bit of momentum going in. But we also have to look at Brooke, considering that, yes, she was was almost eliminated in this episode, but she's won every other challenge in the finale since they've been here. That's pretty crazy to think about.
That's wild. Yeah. She's on fire right now. I mean, exactly what you said. And I think that, I don't know, coming down the stretch, maybe she sees exactly what we're saying. It's like, it's history repeating, and you're so close once again. There's just something about the fire that's under her butt right now that's really working out.
It's just, I think, it's a really good environment for her in terms of using different ingredients in different ways. I mean, she really is just thriving with what they're doing. I do think that the Elimination Challenge exposed a little bit of where Brooke has been a little weaker in this season, which is that if you throw a curveball,
she's not great at improvising.
Yeah, the improvisation is not. She's much more of a planner. She's much more, even though she doesn't need to spell it, she's able to walk through a market like she does in the quickfire and get inspiration from the ingredients that she sees there and cook a great dish. She's able to do that, no problem. It's when you force her to do something, I think, and you take something away or you just arbitrarily change some element that she wasn't planning for, I think that she can struggle a little bit there. But we're not going to see that in the finale, clearly. In the finale, we're going to see a straightforward cook your food for us and impress us challenge. And I think that kind of environment, Brooke will do really well. And I think that she ran up against another just a powerhouse in Kristen Kish in season 10. That's not to say Shirley won't be a powerhouse in the finale here. Shirley has always done just a fantastic job of finding a way to tie the ingredients that they're getting to what she feels like, some experience in her life, some dish that inspired her when she was younger, some experience that just she's had. She does such a good job of bringing herself into what she's cooking and making that shine through. We saw that in this finale challenge where she makes the shrimp salt. And Tom asks, like, look, these aren't your flavors. This isn't typically what you do. How did you adjust to this challenge? And she says, well, yeah, the shrimp salt is me. Like, that's part of my food coming into this cuisine. And I think Shirley just does such a great job of that throughout the season. It will be interesting, given a blank slate and seeing cook us your food in this full meal, what Shirley will do. We don't know what that looks like. We've not really seen a full thing like that on Top Chef. And Shirley can't wait to show us. I can't wait to see it. I think that that'll be a really incredible way to kind of wrap the season, win or lose for Shirley. I'm really excited to see what she puts forth in this finale when she's got kind of free reign to do exactly what she wants. I think in times when we've seen close to that, we get a bowl of hug. We get this comfort food. She finds a way to make a dish that is really appealing in a different way. We've heard chefs say, like, please open your restaurant in this city. I want your food all the time. So I think that she's a powerhouse in her own right. And I think we've got a really fantastic finale shaping up here. I don't know. I thought the habanero was great. It was pretty crazy. I think we see, and I grow habanero in the summer. I think that we see Sheldon and Shirley wearing gloves as they're cutting them, which is something I had to learn the very hard way. Brooke is not doing that. I don't know if we just don't see it, but she's just slicing right in, no problem. So shout out to Brooke for that. I don't know what she's got going on there. She's using the green ones, which she's saying are not as spicy and present a different flavor profile, but I can assure you they're still pretty spicy. So
she's immune to heat.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on there. No gloves for Brooke.
They're not immune to the heat of the kitchen, as she almost didn't get that salsa on the plate, considering that she got it almost stuck in the whatever blender, handheld blender thing she was using. She had to get Sheldon to open it the first time. Then the second time it almost got stuck. And that would have been interesting if, she just put it on the plate with everything else. It's like, here's a pork loin with a big blunt instrument that's filled with salsa that tastes good, I swear.
Poor Sheldon is trying to like bang out like that squash that he roasted and get everything together. It's like 1 minute left, and Brooke can't get the lid off of her container. And it's like, am I going to go ask Sheldon again with 1 minute left while he's plating his squash? Like, I feel pretty rattled here, and you feel for Sheldon. Like he and Brooke really clearly have a great bond, and this Sheldon's never a guy not to help. But even in that moment when Brooke comes over, Sheldon. Like, Brooke, like, come
yeah,
on,
I know.
Like,
yeah.
You got to get this open. Like, don't put this on me. I'm getting my own stuff together here. So it was a it was a tough moment with the blender, but it all worked out in the end. It was one of those classic Top Chef, like, drama that doesn't really end up in something that hurts the dish at the end of the day. And I think that that all worked really well, except for the tamal that we got over there. Shirley's dish also looked fantastic to me. The masa dumpling with the egg drizzle and the chicharron, like, she's just putting together a dish that I wanted to instantly eat, like, right away. So shout out to everybody involved in that quick fire. And I thought the guest judge, my boy Ricardo, like, he said everyone did a fantastic job. He immediately knew everything that they were putting in. I thought that the quick fire looked like it was just food that I wanted to eat. And then we had Jeremiah Tower walking in after the quick fire. Brooke was pretty taken aback by this, Mike. She had apparently been tracking his movements and had lost track of him. And here he is.
Yes, the tracking chip, I guess, failed when he went south of the border. Everything got scrambled. So, Jeremiah Tower, I might make the argument. I didn't know about him coming in, but that's just my own cooking naivete. He might be the most famous chef that has been on the show. Maybe before this, it was like Bourdain or something. But Jeremiah Tower is, I guess, a legend in the cooking scene. He has a place holed up in Mexico, apparently. Brooke sort of lampshades that a bit. But he is here to, with your friend Ricardo, help guide our chef testants through the Maya culture. Much like Survivor Guatemala, they're going to do it like the Maya for this challenge.
Yeah, he presented Jeremiah Tower like a towering figure in cuisine. And I don't know about fame. I mean, you've had Jacques Pepin on, you've had Wolfgang Puck on, you've had some of these like legendary chefs for sure on this show. But he seems to be right up there with them in terms of the way he presents. He just immediately has this gravitas where you're like, okay, this guy is legit. Like, this guy is a legend. And I don't know what he did to kind of interpret or help develop California cuisine, but clearly that's what Brooke assigns to him. This is not somebody that comes off lightly, which is why I thought it was incredible in the elimination challenge. After Shirley presents her dish and she's done with the patter and she walks away, there's this kind of silence, and Jeremiah Tower breaks it by saying, "That girl can cook." And I was like, wow, that really just came off to me like a major, major, major compliment. I think the show did a fantastic job of presenting that. There's a little beat there, and then he says that, and it's like, okay, that really landed for me when he said that. It felt like a major, major compliment. All right, we'll edit that silence out.
No, double it. Double it.
Double it? We'll double it? No, double
that.
Yeah,
make it like 30 seconds of silence.
Okay, this is great. We have to, it's the beat, so we really know how significant of a chef that Jeremiah Tower is.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought they did a great job. The host of Top Chef Mexico was there. I still really want to watch Top Chef Mexico. Josh or Mike,
how do we
is
get
there?
Our hands on that? How do we get our hands on some of that sweet Top Chef Mexico action?
We have to ask Katsuji. He was a former contestant on it, so. I mean,
anyone
got a
line on
Katsuji?
I mean, now that Kurt and John are best friends, he's got to be able to get to Katsuji next.
No, that's complete opposite.
Oh, right. Sorry. I got my notes mixed up. I apologize.
Is there a Mexican bum diddlyumptious who's been subtitling the Mexican Top Chef
yes,
for all of us?
Bum diddlyumptious. Oh, he is putting up links.
Oh my God! Q Extreme Way is right now. You just broke the game.
Josh, is Sangman on Top Chef Mexico?
Stop. You're talking about the greatest show of all time, if that's where we're going. I don't want to even think about that. It hurts my head too much.
All right. No spoilers on The Genius Mexico.
But
we'll
I would love to see Senor Sangman cook his way through and you know, mind F his way through everyone in the game.
Yeah. So if you know a way to get your hands on Top Chef Mexico, especially if subtitled, do let us know. That's something I'm very interested to watch. I think that, as we talked about last week on the podcast, Top Chef does a good job, I think, in the times they've been to Mexico. And I think they've proved that it was worth going back to Mexico, because I think we have ultimately very different things that are being presented in each of their Mexico stops. And I think that in the minds of a lot of people in the broad Top Chef audience, you probably think of Mexican food in really the kind of most popular way that it's presented in the U.S. But clearly, there are different regions of Mexico, and those end up with very different cuisines. And we're seeing ultimately how that plays out within the context of both this finale, this multi-part finale, and the times we've seen Mexico on Top Chef in previous seasons. We're getting very different cuisines presented in very different ways. I thought it was cool to highlight the more rustic kind of prep with the Mayan element and the ingredients therein. I thought we did get the kind of history lesson of those ingredients on this episode with Jeremiah Tower and ultimately with Ricardo Munoz Zurita. Like, we had the kind of class that they went through. I don't know that it helped Shirley win the challenge. It did seem to help Brooke find her hit of acid that she was looking for, which I think in California would have been a lot easier to track down. But yeah, I thought that that class was very interesting because even though the ingredients were taken away from them, I thought it seemed like they had the information they needed in order to prepare the dishes they wanted regardless. I don't know why it maybe threw people for a loop in the way that it did, but it seemed like that class should have helped. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Do you guys remember, have we ever seen like a class like that before we had a challenge where we've really broken down like very specific things and said, this is what you're going to be cooking with?
Not to my knowledge, but I don't have that depth of knowledge here.
I mean, could you say that, like, would going on the shrimp boat and finding out about the different shrimp that they use, could that be a form of that? It's not as outright as this is how you cook a shrimp, but I feel like there's been a many, many instances where they've done some sort of experience before the challenge to learn about, you know, a certain type of way of cooking or a certain ingredient, and then Padmé immediately says, okay, you're going to utilize that for your next challenge. But as was mentioned, it probably was not as in-depth, specific, right, and historical as this instance.
Right. This seemed to be much more of a thing where think about like the challenge where there was a pop-up restaurant and you had to go into that person's restaurant and you were given that person as a resource. And whether it was a vegan restaurant or whether it was an Asian restaurant or whatever the flavor profiles you were working with, you had an expert on site who you could have gotten a lot of information from and learned, you know, what to do. And we saw people struggle with that who didn't ask questions of the person. This seemed to be much more formalized. This was almost like a class where they were taken in, they were given instructions specifically on a lot of different things and why certain things were used in the way they were. And they had the opportunity to ask questions, and we saw people asking questions. We saw Sheldon, for example, asking about the acid and about like how the things were going on. And we heard other people really kind of seeing how that played out. But this was a very formal, like, okay, like, we're going to teach you about the ingredients to this. I was just kind of a little surprised that when we got to the challenge, there was a bit of a loop that was thrown there, because it felt like, okay, these are the ingredients that you just heard about the day before that you took extensive notes on. I feel like something might have been missing there. I guess it was just that they didn't tell them what wouldn't be there, even if they told them what would be there. So I think that might have been what threw them for the loop there. But we had this extensive class with everybody before, and I think we did see, and we had Jeremiah Tower remark on it. Like, we did see Brooke remembering the tomatillos. She's used them before in her own cooking, but she uses that juice to provide acid when she would have maybe used limes or some other fruit or citrus before. So we did see that being adapted into the food that was used, maybe with varying levels of success. But I thought that that was an interesting aspect to this challenge that maybe didn't have a huge impact on how Shirley won, but was definitely present in what everything was doing. Josh, have you ever been to a cenote? Is this the same cenote we've seen? Or should, you know, people swim in these on other seasons of other reality shows, these sinkhole caves? Was this a cool place for you to see the final challenge?
You think that this is just like the default cenote? Like, every time you see a cenote in a movie or a television show, this is the one they're going to?
It's like the TV cenote. Like, yeah. It's been prepped. It's got nice makeup. It shows really well under the lights.
It's great for, it's great for sound. It's got decent lighting, surprisingly. It's cool. I would like to go into one of those. That looks pretty neat.
You would assume that any cenote is good for sound, though, right? Or maybe horrible for sound, depending on the echoes.
It was good for sweat. I mean, everybody, including the judges, seemed to be drenched in sweat. So there's that. I don't know. I mean, it was nighttime, so I don't know if there were like Klieg lights set up or if there were the lighting set up for the challenge was making people like that. But I mean, Sheldon walks up to deliver. I mean, I know he's been like hunched over an open flame trying to chisel his fish off of the grill. But yeah, he's drenched in sweat. The judges are drenched in sweat. It's a sweaty, sweaty final challenge. I think that might be why we didn't see Gail Simmons. Gail's too good for this. She's not going to come out here and sweat like crazy for, you know, for this challenge. I think Gail's above that. Plus, wasn't she in the Watch What Happens Live Clubhouse? Wasn't that what happened here?
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah.
Who was she with?
The one and only Dale Earnhardt Jr.
Dale Earnhardt Jr.?
Gale Earnhardt Jr.
That's I'll ship it. I'll ship it.
were those hip hop horns, Josh?
Yeah,
that's what
I just. Yeah, I just. Okay. I just tossed out
Gale
the air
Earnhardt
horns.
Jr. The beloved Canadian Southern race car driver chef. slash,
sounds like the perfect human.
Food and wine provocateur. I don't know exactly how that would play out, but you might be teasing Top Chef Birmingham next season, which if we didn't have Chef Jim's as a returning contestant, forget it.
Jim's needs to be the head chef for that one. I know Tom might have to take a break just to have Jim step in.
No Gail Simmons. We got Graham Elliott. That means, I guess, I don't know who we'll see on the finale. I think that we didn't have to deal with any Richard Blaze this episode, so that was good. Josh, you haven't podcasted with us in a couple of weeks. Can you just weigh in on what Richard Blaze was like last episode, please?
He was Richard Blazed. I mean, he was just like lit up clearly from all the tequila. Yeah, it was a little bit rough around the edges, the Richard Blaze. I enjoyed the Tom shade towards Richard Blaze was especially notable. He was clearly not enjoying it.
Yeah, you just got to deal with this guy. Like, oh yeah, like get over it. Like, Richard Blaze just trying to tell Brooke she wasn't like the dish was too simple. I mean, we're
really
not gonna get into this again.
I mean, yeah, we don't have to go into a huge tangent other than to say like that's pretty crummy coming from somebody who has been in those shoes before, who has won and lost in this high pressure situation. So don't act like you've never screwed up in this position before. So have a little bit of empathy, maybe. Not to get too hard on the Richard Blaze thing, but it was a little shitty, I thought.
It was just we didn't see that this episode, obviously.
Which I appreciated.
Yeah, we had judges who are not making themselves like this.
Can you imagine like if Richard Blaze was just like tossing Sheldon down the well over all of Sheldon's mistakes in this episode when everybody else is like, Sheldon, no, we don't want to lose you, but we have to.
Sheldon, you're the reason why the Maya all died off. They tried your fish and they mass exodus.
Yeah, it would just be awful. So I'm really glad he wasn't there for what was clearly, no matter how it broke, was going to be an emotional, fragile situation. He's just he doesn't have that bedside manner. I don't know. I don't need Richard Blaze on Top Chef anymore.
No, I think I'm done too. And we've been over this extensively this season. But it was nice to see the judges, I think, present in a way that didn't put themselves at the forefront. And as I've said throughout, I like Graham Elliott. Like, he seems to make good comments. He pointed out the tester fish issue. He knew that that was a thing that probably was relevant, and it was relevant. And that ultimately was, I think, one of the big deciding factors, ultimately, is that Sheldon actively waited to see what Brooke and Shirley were doing with the fish. Wanted to do something different, and it cost him. And we know that the desire to do it differently was the thing that did him in. It was also a bold move that maybe could have made him win. So it is what it is. He took a risk, as Katsuji would say, and it didn't pay off in terms of what happened. But I thought great observations by the judges here. Mike, you already said that you felt like Sheldon was telegraphed 40 minutes in, like he's going home. Josh, did you feel like there was any drama in the elimination, or did you feel they tried to set it up like maybe they're, you know, they could have gone either way, that it was a really tough call. But did you feel like that was ultimately the case or not?
No, because I think even in like presenting the two scenarios of like, you know, when Tom, like before he sent them all away, was like, you know, this is really difficult. In Brooke's case, you have a really beautiful fish, but it's, you know, it's overseasoned or it's like there's too much going on. And in Sheldon, like your fish was a mess and like didn't give like a what you did right. You know, like didn't give like a at least you have a beautiful fish like he gave to Brooke. Like there was no complimentary equivalent. It was pretty clear that Sheldon was going home. I would have been really surprised if Brooke was going here. It felt like Mike said earlier, like really, you know, pretty quickly into the episode and certainly quickly into the challenge. Like as soon as the fish is getting destroyed, it's like, ah, man, that sucks. That's such a terrible way to go. And from that moment forward, you're kind of just enjoying every last second of Sheldon you've got.
And we've seen that on this season a couple of times, I think, where there's just some issue that clearly is too much to overcome. And it's maybe anticlimactic in terms of who goes home. There have been some very climactic. There's been some very suspenseful eliminations, clearly. But we've seen some where that was not the case, ultimately. So and I just think that this one was more of the latter, where ultimately I agree that I also feel like there were more negative comments on Sheldon's dish. dish than at the end of the day. I felt like the too spicy comment was one that stood out, because if you've got something where it presented to a couple people was too bold from a flavor standpoint, and the fish was kind of broken up the way it was, even if it tasted like crab, at the end of the day, it wasn't the fact that his dish was bolder and smarter, maybe, or more composed in that regard than Brooks, was just not enough to win out. It was never going to overcome the hurdle that he created for himself with the cookery of the fish, the grilling of the fish. So at the end of the day, there we are. It still was a heartbreaking thing for people. I mean, we're receiving tweets as people are watching the episode that just say, no, Kelly Emmett tweeted that as she's watching, like tweeting throughout. And we see a lot of comments in our Facebook group about this sort of thing. So and Natalie Franklin had said, I'm so sure that Brooke is going to win that there was no drama for me tonight. That's, I think, a comment on the season as a whole.
Yeah.
Mike or Josh, do you guys feel that way? Like the season as a whole has positioned Brooke so much that there was no drama in the elimination from this episode?
I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't go all the way to that line, but I would say, like, if you had to make a prediction going into the finale, gun to your head, and I don't think I would even need to take it that far, I would say that Brooke is going to win.
No,
this
then
thing
you get the adrenaline flowing then, Josh.
Yeah, maybe that would help, but I don't think it's necessary. This is not a difficult choice for me. It's not a hard prediction to make. I think Brooke's going to win. I think it's felt that way for a while, but I wouldn't be shocked if Shirley won. I would also be elated if Shirley won, because she is awesome as well. I feel like this has been Brooke's season.
Yeah, Shirley says a gun to your head helps you make really great decisions. I agree, but what I will sort of tamper that with is that I think I said this on previous podcasts. There is no Top Chef winners edit. There have been instances in the past, your Kevins, your Hoseas, your Nicholases, where you know they might not even be visible the first four or five episodes, and then somehow they're able to make their way to the end and end up beating people that are much bigger characters. We could even see that with Shirley this season. I mean, Shirley and Sheldon in the first like three or four episodes really weren't shown that much outside of Sheldon's injury. It was only around like that second third of the competition when they really came into light and eventually came this far. But I don't think that necessarily counts out Shirley. I think we've been seeing a lot of Brooke because Brooke has one of the biggest stories going in, you know, that she was unceremoniously defeated by someone who came back from Last Chance Kitchen at the end of her season. And as a result, you know, has sort of been maligning the concept of Last Chance Kitchen and sort of regretting it ever since. Now she has an opportunity to do it again. It would suck if she went out before she had an opportunity to really capitulate on that and really earn the W, but at the same time, you know, I don't necessarily think that the other two had such weak stories that, you know, it would have made sense for them to go. So I see where they're coming, where Natalie's coming from, in that, you know, Brooke has a really big story that needs to have some finality to it, but I wouldn't have been 100% surprised if, cooking aside just from a story perspective, if Brooke went out here and Sheldon moved on, just because he had a big story too.
I think that's my observation, is that Sheldon and Brooke had the two biggest stories. And so we're going into a finale now where we have one person who's just had a much bigger story. And granted, the natural story there, without having to fictionalize anything, I think is a easier story to tell. The idea, as you're hitting, Mike, that Brooke has carried around this grudge or this issue with Last Chance Kitchen, and now she's emerged from it. The fact that she didn't even get to show all her food in her previous finale because of a chef who returned from Last Chance Kitchen, and now here we are, shoe on the other foot. Like, that's one of those, you can't write it like this kind of stories. And so that's a much easier story to tell than ultimately Shirley's very compelling story about everything that she's got going on and the need to prove her career choice as a chef, the effort that she puts in and the people that she's worked with and the food that she cooks and everything kind of culminating in this finale for her. I think that's still a very compelling story as we've talked about, but it's just not the story that we have with Brooke, where it's much easier to tell in that regard. So I think Brooke had the big story. Sheldon had as big of a story, and Shirley was somewhere at the back of those two. So I do think it seems to us, if you're reading like who has the most story on this season, like Brooke would be the winner because she has more of the story. But ultimately, Top Chef, when you talk about lack of a winner's edit, Mike, when we see Shirley going home against Nina in her season, we know how that season ended, and it was not a season that ended with the storybook chef taking the title. So
I'm just glad that Kurt's not here to defend the outcome.
Yeah, well, so am I. I'm glad Kurt got meat slapped into silence.
Thank you, meat.
Yes. Thank you, John Tesar's knife meat. So ultimately, very glad to see that Kurt is not here to defend that outcome, because that was, there are other seasons of Top Chef as well where the story, the storybook edit is not the winner. And so the lack of a Top Chef winner's edit is real. It just seems like Brooke has definitely had more of the screen time. She's been more of the narrator. She's been more of the person who has told us about everything that's going on in her life and why she came back and why it's meaningful to her. So if we're going to put a bow on a story, that seems to be the one we're going to get. And I submit that if it's a really close finale and that Shirley cooks incredibly well and Brooke just does a little bit better, I think Shirley's story still has a bow on it. I think there's still validation there. I think you can still say she got to the finals, cooked incredibly well. She only lost because she was cooking against someone who is one of the best competitors this show has seen. So no shame in that. And Shirley is a fantastic competitor, win or lose. I would love to see either one of the two win. I would have been fine with any of the final four winning, as we've talked about.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to see ultimately just the food that they put forth in this finale.
That being said, Brooke is just primed to go full Kish. You know, like it's so there to do the Kristen Kish thing of getting knocked out and coming back in and then getting to the finale and winning. It would be so perfect. It'd be so poetic. So I don't know. I just feel like that's what's in the air. You know, not any edit reading or anything like that. I just like feel like that's the outcome we're driving towards.
Well, we did get a question from Jack May about that, and he said, if Brooke wins, can we just end LCK forever? But I think Magical Elves would take the exact opposite approach. I think I said this last season when Amar almost won. I think they're going to look at that if Brooke wins, if Kristen wins, Amar makes it to the finals, and they say, hey, LCK is producing finalists. This is a great concept that totally works. Let's keep bringing it back. So much to your chagrin, Josh, I feel like if Brooke wins, they're going to double down on LCK and say this is something that produces Top Chef winners.
It would be to my chagrin.
Yeah, I think that it would be to your chagrin, for sure. But I think that it would be something where ultimately there can be some value in it. That doesn't mean there's value week to week. It doesn't mean it's not something that they can't find a different way to present. But it does mean that this is a thing they're going to embrace. If Brooke wins, this will be the second time it's happened in what, like, I don't know how many seasons I've had Last Chance Kitchen, 6 or 7. That's a pretty strong representation there. It wouldn't shock me ultimately if it's something they lean into even more going forward, much to your chagrin, Josh. I do wonder, we had some other questions here. Let's kind of look forward to the finale a little bit without spoiling what was in the next on the finale. Last season, we had the finale where the sous chefs were, or we had an episode, I'm not sure, was it the finale, where their mentors came in?
How could you forget Amar and Charlie Palmer's Jerry Springer-esque reunion?
That was so awkward. Yeah, that was incredible.
I remember that. I just didn't remember that it was on the finale. I remember that being very difficult to watch. And that was, their mentors came back. They were their sous chefs. It caused a problem. That was, I guess, in the finale after all. Jeremy was Jean-Georges came in and really helped him. It seems like that's something that they got a lot of mileage of. We're probably going to see returnees to be their sous chefs again in the next episode. We had a question about that ultimately, the question was from PJ Gogan. It was basically, who would it be? Who do you think that these, if we're bringing people back next episode to be their sous chefs, who are we going to see? You think, Josh, we'll see another mentorship kind of thing where we're just going to see their mentors come in?
Yeah, I was thinking that, or like somebody from their staff or anything like that, like some sort of like really close colleague. I do think like that's going to be the person that they're picking. I was wondering like how it's going to work in terms of format, where they say we're picking the third one for you. Like, does that influence strategy at all in like terms of how you're picking the sous chefs of the other people that you played against earlier in the season?
Well, a couple things on that. First, I think that they would, in true Top Chef fashion, tell them afterwards. So I think they're just going to say, okay, we're just going to pick two, and then Pamela will say, you know, hold up, bros, let's bring in these third, you know, mystery third guests. I think someone from the staff would be interesting. I do think, I think we talked about this in our finale podcast last year. I think the only reason why they brought in the mentors last season was because Amar and Jeremy both had such illustrious mentors that, you know, they were able to fly them in, and it was really such a big deal. I do think someone on their staff would be interesting. I wonder, had Shirley's husband, had Jimmy been working in her restaurant instead of, you know, shepherding around her around going from restaurant to restaurant every day. It would have been interesting to bring back their significant others because, as we know, Brooke's husband basically runs the restaurant part and parcel with her. And so obviously I think he has a lot of culinary knowledge. That would have been interesting, but I wonder if that won't be the case since, obviously, again, Jimmy does not really have that much culinary experience, even though he's now been on the show before. So I'm going to kind of go along with your theory, Josh. I think it might be like their own personal sous chefs from their restaurants.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems very possible, right? And I should say, when we mentioned earlier that part of the reason they might have leaned into it last season was because they had such sterling mentors. I mean, we heard Shirley talk about on this episode that she worked for Jose Andreas. I mean, that's a pretty reputable dude right there. And I'm sure Brooke, I can't remember exactly who she has kind of staged with or like the places that she served or apprenticed under. But I remember that she's worked with some very notable chefs as well. So it could be a situation where we've got notable mentors again for them to bring in. It didn't seem like that will be the case. It does seem like maybe it'll be someone that's more associated with their restaurants because at this point, they're the kind of heavy hitters. This is their all-stars returning season. Let's give a little shine to the people that are supportive of them. So we did not see Brooke's husband on the Family Challenge. This would be a pretty good time to see him. It'll be interesting to see how this ultimately plays out. I think we'll have to see some returning chefs as well. We did see that last season, like you were saying, Mike, where it's kind of like, person, and then, a random third person, here we are. And so I'm looking forward to that in the finale. If there are no more tricks, that would be fine by me. Anything else we want to cover, guys, in this episode before we wrap up here?
No, I'm good.
There is one little thing, and I think we talked about this a couple of episodes ago with Brooke and Padma having a couple of spats back and forth in the episode where she was first eliminated. We got it here, I feel like, a judge's table. If we're going Brooke versus Shirley here, and if we're going down the line of judges of who we think is going to support each one, I kind of have the feeling that Padma's going to be in the Shirley camp. Just a hunch based on the fact that I don't know if Padma's judging Brooke on a different rubric since she knows how good of a cook she is or something. But I mean, in this episode, you know, Padma is the woman of heat. She always in every challenge is talking about like, oh, this needs more spice. This isn't giving me enough heat. And almost everyone around her disagrees. Like, no, there's enough heat here. We're giving flot sweat at how much heat there is in this dish. But Padma, this episode at the judges table, you know, when it really came down to Brooke versus Sheldon, she was very anti-Brooke saying like, well, you know what? Sheldon at least tried. Brooke really didn't. So it will be interesting seeing if she can tamper those opinions going into the finale or if we're going to have one anti-Brooke person on the panel going in.
That's interesting. I had not really read that myself. And I think Padma usually presents with an open mind in terms of these finales, especially. But she is often a voice of dissent from Tom. Like, there is often a disagreement there. There seem to be sometimes things about dishes that just offend Padma or upset her. And that is ultimately what she seizes on. Sometimes at the expense of saying, I forget what the challenge was early this year, but there was a dish that was just not prepared properly. And Padma was more interested in the one that might have been prepared properly, but she didn't like as being the one that was worse. So I think she sometimes has a different perspective than some of the other judges. And I think that oftentimes that makes her a voice of dissent for different reasons. And I do think we won't see necessarily a unified judges panel at this finale. I hope they're able to put any biases that might exist aside. I don't sense that there are too many. Padma sent Sheldon home, cried doing it, but sent him home. So I think that even if she's emotionally invested to the point where she's in tears, she's able to make those calls and agree with the judge's consensus. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out. Anything else? Any other questions we need to hit from any listeners, Mike, or anything else that we want to cover here?
No, I mean, you spoke about Padma crying briefly. I know Elizabeth asked us, has Padma ever cried after saying, pack your knives and go? Reaching into the brief recesses of my Top Chef memory, I can imagine her being very, very emotional before. I'm pretty sure when Sheldon actually went home the first time, she was pretty choked up. So I think Padma does have times before when she was emotional sending people home. I mean, she has a heart and Sheldon's absolutely lovable. But this might be the most emotion she's shown sending somebody home.
Yeah, she even prefaced it like before they, you know, all went away. She's like, whoever we choose, this is going to be incredibly painful. Like she knew right off the jump, like this is going to be awful. I can't remember seeing anything like that from Padma before.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a sign, I think, in other ways. Like, when Padma sent Brooke home the first time, there was a lot of emotion in it, but we didn't see her in tears. And I think that was because Last Chance Kitchen was there, and it wasn't ultimately final. We did see that very emotional moment from Gail, ultimately, with that elimination. But Padma wasn't as torn up, but it wasn't at this stage in the competition. It is tough, I think, when you're someone like Chef John or Chef Sheldon, and you go out at this stage, and there isn't the Last Chance Kitchen. It's almost like, maybe I'd be better off, like, cooking my way back in. And having my second shot if I was gonna screw up and have my moment. And Brooke talks about that being very formative and being very telling. She died and she came back to life. So now she's maybe not as afraid of dying as she was before. It was cathartic to get that loss off of her chest, and we didn't get that from some of these other chefs. So maybe there is something to that, that Brooke has articulated, that losing a little bit earlier was actually way more beneficial to her in the long run, and that it recentered her and got her focus in the right place and got that fear of being eliminated off of her back. And the other chefs that have been eliminated since Last Chance Kitchen ended didn't have that opportunity. It doesn't seem like that's what held them back, but there's something to be said for reemerging from Last Chance Kitchen and feeling like you're maybe a little more indestructible. It hurt Dougie when he reemerged from Last Chance Kitchen. He won early on. Like, he won after he came back, but then he decided he was going to take these big swings. Like, I think he felt almost too invincible, and that took him down. So Brooke has reemerged from Last Chance Kitchen. She seems stronger for it. And there does seem to be this a lot of emotion in whether she could have gone home this time, with Padma saying, like, if no matter who we cut, it's going to be difficult. So I think that there's a lot of emotion with Padma and with everyone else, for everyone that was left at this point. I think we see that play out on the show. I think it's going to be a great finale. I think the emotions are going to be all over the map. We're going to see finale food. We're going to see, like, the struggles. We're going to see the emotions of people come back. We're going to see all of that in one episode, 2 versus 2. It's going to be your best versus my best. I'm really personally looking forward to this finale. It's
much more than a year ago.
Yes.
I'll tell you that.
As heartbreaking as it is to lose Sheldon, I think, you know, it's supplemented by the fact that we have two great chef testants moving on. Last year, no offense to Jeremy and Amar, but again, losing Isaac and Marjorie due to a magic trick challenge was really tough to swallow, even a year later.
Yeah, just like the exact wrong two people. it was just the worst situation. Imagine the Marjorie Isaac. Oh, God, that would have been the best finale. But this is great. This is great. And I really think, again, as we've said multiple times, like, any permutation of a final two here out of that final three or even final four would have been pretty great.
Yeah, it is ultimately just freaking magicians. We don't need to talk about it, but yeah, it is ultimately something where we've seen. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just so angry about magicians. We've seen that play out in different seasons where the finale has been not as thrilling, either in the result or in the pairing. And this is just one where it just seems like a perfect storm of everything, and it would have been regardless. But I'm just really looking forward to this finale, and in a way that maybe I haven't since season 10. And I'm just thrilled for both the contestants who made it. I'm really excited for them to have the opportunity that they're going to have. But I'm excited that Sheldon won the James Beard Challenge and got to do the cook your food thing in an incredible place, and in a place that he'd always dreamed about. That review is up, Josh, and I'm curious. I guess you read it, but I'm curious if anyone else was at the event who's listening to this podcast or has anything to say about that. We'd love to hear it. But I think that seemed like an incredible event. I would have liked to have gone to that for sure. And looking forward. I don't go to Hawaii a lot, so I'm looking forward to getting the chance to try everyone's cuisine at some point in the future. But I have to make a special trip, I guess, to try Sheldon's at this point. So fantastic opportunity there. Fantastic finale we've got lined up. Anything else, guys?
No. Rippin' habanero pepper Sheldon.
Any other podcasts that you guys are on right now that you want to plug? Anything you guys are doing?
Just some post-show recapping. We're walking in pure Walking Dead mode, really in the thick of that, which is great.
That's not what's keeping you busy right now.
Josh, you were bearing the lead majorly here.
What's the lead? I don't have a lead.
Josh has many leads that he picked up last summer in Fiji. If you're a Survivor fan and you're not checking out Josh's fantastic stuff on Parade, his preseason interviews, what are you doing? Get there now. Catch up. They're a lot of fun. Josh,
get to the Parade.
Get down. With the articles, Josh, you're what, like halfway through at this point? More than halfway through?
Oh, yeah. More than halfway through. As we're recording this, we are going into the final week or so of player profiles that I still have to churn out. And then a couple of other stories that are going to be popping up both on Parade.com and THR.com, bringing some Survivor coverage over to the Hollywood Reporter this year. Got a really fun thing that's in the works for that that I can't say much about, but I'm actually really pumped about it, and I think you guys will be too if you're a Survivor fan.
If you, if you're a Top Chef, if you're somehow involved with Magical Elves or Bravo and you're listening to this, next time you do a Top Chef returning player season, get Josh Wiggler out there. Have him do a little pregame work. Yeah. He makes the characters so much more compelling that are coming back by telling their stories, letting them speak about what they're planning on, telling the pregame story that builds so much hype. There's just, it's really, I echo what Mike said. Like, if you're a Survivor fan, like, there's so, Survivor doing a returning player season with the theme of game changers, hearing about how these players view themselves and what they're bringing into this game, how they might be trying to change their own games. They know about each other. What do they think about each other, or the other competitors? There's just so much there, and there's so much depth there. It just, the hype for this season for me is getting off the charts, in large part to as a result of what Josh is writing. So next
Way
time we have
kind.
Top Chef,
I really appreciate that. Thank you. That's
next time we
ridiculous.
Have Top Chef returning players, we've got to have Josh Wiggler getting.
I'll go.
There.
I'll go as long as I can eat. You know, let me eat some of that. Food,
It'd be really criminal if you couldn't eat.
Yeah. It'd be fun. Hey, listen. Yeah, if you're listening, I write for the Hollywood Reporter. That feels like a
pretty
Wiggler
big deal, for hire.
Right? You know, I'm Wiggler for hire. Yeah, I have no problem shilling myself right now. But the Survivor stuff, speaking of, you can read at parade.com/Survivor Game Changers.
There it is. There it
do
is.
It,
and
do
Mike,
it.
what have you been working on?
So our coverage of the Celebrity Apprentice wrapped up last week. The season itself went out a little bit like a lamb, but if you have not checked it out yet, Rob was able to sit down with the winner of Celebrity Apprentice and host of American Ninja Warrior, Matt Eisman. Really, really good interview. Whether if you watch Celebrity Apprentice or you don't, or if you watch American Ninja Warrior or you don't, check it out. Matt is a super fantastic guy. I am so proud that he was able to shut down a joke that I made and call it hacky. I'm going to treasure that comment for the rest of my life. So definitely check that out. Otherwise, some other things in the works, but probably nothing for now until next week when we come back for the finale, guys. It's been a long season. I can't believe what we're wrapping it up next week.
We're wrapping it up next week. It's been a long season. Might not be the final episode we have of Top Chef coverage of this season after next week. We'll figure that out going forward. But we will talk about the finale next week here at Reality TV Wrap Ups. If you want to subscribe to what we do, go to robhasawebsite.com/TC podcast in iTunes. That will allow you to subscribe and get every episode of our Top Chef podcast. So if we post episodes after the finale, it's an easy way to stay in the loop there. You can also go to robhasawebsite.com/Top Chef. If you don't use iTunes for your podcast, but you use some other service, subscriptions, comments, ratings, reviews are always appreciated by what we do, or by us here for what we do at Reality TV Wrap Ups, talking about Top Chef. We will return next week with our finale coverage. Kurt Clark will be back, having been unmuted by his meat slapping. Guys, do we have a hashtag for this podcast episode?
Oh my God. I tried to write a couple of down. We had YouTube cans at one point. But I'm afraid of what happens when you start searching for YouTube cans.
Safe search. Shulk stuck out to me as well.
Shulk was there. Shirley You Can was also on there.
How do we spell Shulk?
Put an S at the beginning of Hulk.
Yes, it's the Sheldon Hulk. Yes, yeah. You will like me. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry. So no. I think we should go with Shulk. Hashtag S-H-U-L-K. Hopefully that's not an Urban Dictionary term that none of us are aware of.
It's the name of a video game character. But then we have Synergy. It's great. We're going across mediums.
So use the hashtag Shulk, S-H-U-L-K, Sheldon Hulk, if you want to talk about this episode of this podcast. You can tweet at us. I am at AC Mazzaro with 2 Z's and 1 R. Josh, you are at Round Howard, and Mike, you are at A Mike Bloom Type. Is everything in order there?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Vale.
You can always... You can always follow or tweet at Kurt Clark to hear about his experience at Knife Dallas, or to just give him a hard time about how Magic really did ruin that Top Chef finale. Go ahead and tweet at Kurt if you'd like to hear that as well. We will be back next week. Thanks, as always, to Scott St. Pierre for all the behind-the-scenes work and getting this podcast up and posted. And thanks to everyone for listening. Take care.